Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 202 on probate leads, probate data, and real estate deals with Bill Gross. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Today's guest, Bill Gross, is a real estate agent, investor, and probate expert currently working the California real estate market. Most real estate attorneys, agents, and investors have no idea how to properly probate an estate quickly. Probate deals often linger on for months and sometimes years before finally receiving a clear to close and getting us all paid. Bill's focus is exactly those types of deals. He finds the most challenging probate cases and quickly clears the issues and gets to closing quickly where everyone gets paid. Bill and I go deep on probate and share quite a few resources, including where to get probate data, how to work probate leads, and the number one nationwide resource for handling probate cases. Hint, this is not your local attorney. Please enjoy this conversation with Bill Gross. Bill Gross, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. So I like to location and market stamp my episodes lately. Whereabouts in the U.S. are you recording from and doing business?
Well, I'm in Los Angeles, California, where I live. I have lived here for 25 years. I'm a native Southern Californian. I do business throughout California. And probate real estate tends to have a wide geography. So I've sold or currently listed property in 8 counties in California. So I would say the state of California overall.
Nice. All right, cool. So let's take it back to the beginning, the origination story. How did you, Bill, get into real estate in the first place?
Well, I was born in real estate.
Okay, yes, as we all were, right?
Well, I think when you're brand new, how do you say that? I say tell people you've been in real estate your whole life because you've been in real estate your whole life. You started in a hospital and you went home from there. I had a career in computers and electronics. And then in 1986, I was out looking to raise money for my own business. Went to lunch with my brother who was in the mortgage business. And after lunch, he said, hey, stop in with me and pretend you're my partner. And we went in this office and he was a mortgage broker at the time. And it just seemed interesting. He's talking to people. They treat him with respect. I came from more of a corporate environment and everything was about electronics, computers, and satellite systems. And it seemed so real, the real estate. So I was raising money and about a week later, we went to lunch again. He and I were pretty close. And again, he said, just pretend my partner this time. Tell him you're going to do this. And I did that. And afterwards, he said, you know, you're really good at this. Let's work together. And so I started as a mortgage lender for a savings and loan, one that said we'll always be there. It was no longer there in 1986. And I've been in real estate ever since. I've been in mortgages and real estate. I've been in sales, management, and ownership. And then, I got into coaching and management recruiting. And about 3.5 years ago, the second company in a row I had worked for started having problems and they couldn't grow anymore, whether it be capital or some ownership problems. And I realized that I wanted to have more control of my own destiny. So 3 years ago, I went back into sales full time and I kind of designed a plan based on probate real estate. And so I've done that for the last 3 years and built a pretty successful business focusing on probate real estate sales.
So we're going to get into the probate here in depth, but before we do that, we'll take a couple little detours here to help paint the picture. First of all, how's your brother doing? Is he still in the business? Is he an agent? Is he a broker? Where did he land?
He retired. He had some health issues, and fortunately had accumulated some rental property where he was able to retire on the income from his, primarily from his real estate and then some other investments as well. So he's done well.
Sweet. Sorry to hear about the health issues, but good news that he's all set with the investments, right?
I think that the real estate can come across as you have to work 24/7. He had that personality, and I think he burned out on that. And over time, he realized he wanted to do more. And frankly, he ended up moving into retirement, remarried, has a child. He's just doing great. So it's really worked out. And real estate allowed him to do that, you know, to have the choice to retire and focus on his family. So I think he's really doing really well.
Nice. Do you buy and hold any rental property at all yourself, Bill?
I don't. I think you have to know. He was a buy and hold investor, and he loved when tenants called him and plugged up, plumbing, and he'd run over there on a Saturday night and he'd pull out his tools. He enjoyed that. I can't stand it. If you look behind me, those boards I have, I call my son-in-law to hang them. I can't do anything. So I just do what I call lipstick flips. In the course of my business, if I find a property that I can clean out, fix up, shoot pictures and remarket it, I do that to flip it. And then I put my money elsewhere. So nice. I work a lot of hours in real estate. I'm a full-time broker. I have in mind another year or two of sales, and then I'll start doing some buy and hold investment at that time. But for now, I just don't have the time to deal with it.
Yeah, fair enough. So what are the numbers looking like for the last 12 months? How many houses, did you end up doing as an investment versus how many as a broker in a conventional sales method?
Last 12 months, I closed about 30 transactions as a broker. And I think 31 or 32. And I did two investments I flipped. I call lipstick flips. I made really good money on both of them. Again, because I'm busy and I'm making good money in sales, it has to be profitable and it has to be fast. And so these were two properties that I came across them and I could just see, wow, all you got to do is junk it out and then clean it up and shoot photos and market it properly and resell it. And I made over $50,000 on both of them.
Nice. What were the price points on the flips?
I think both were in the neighborhood of $400,000. And I got in for $420,000 on one and I want to say 3D and the other. And then both of them we sold. I had a partner on both of them. It just worked better for me. I have a friend who's a contractor on one and another guy who's kind of a construction guy on the other. And so they went and saw the property and physically and figured out what we had to worry about, what we didn't have to worry about. And in both cases, we just said, hey, let's just clean this out and sell it. And we made money on it.
Nice. And I imagine you've done that a few times before in your career.
One or two a year. I mean, I'd like to do more. Part is just, the distraction of a successful business and life and everything else. My wife and I had our first grandchild this year. So, just
congratulations.
Thank you. It's another distraction, but maybe a reason to work on it more. So yeah, definitely. There's no excuse for it. I teach all the time, but I really wanted to build this real estate business. It was something I really chased. I think being in coaching and management, you teach other people how to do it. And I always knew I could do really well. And frankly, I really surpassed my goals here in the last 2 years. It's been great.
Nice. Congratulations. Yeah. And I mean, we take 34 transactions that you talked about, 32 sides in the brokerage and two flips. And, we do the math, 50, maybe paid the partner out. I mean, the 30 with zero risk in the brokerage side of the business is probably about the balance, right? It's the number of deals that come across your plate and that's it. There's probably only two flips out of the 34 deals that you have. And I think a lot of investors out here, myself included, I've ignored the 30 for a long time. We didn't really do anything with them. We tried to refer them to agents. We just couldn't get it going. And I'm sure there's a lot of fix and flip investors who are listening as well, who it's like we're dead focused, laser focused on the fix and flip only, to the exclusion and leaving on the table the 30 unsatisfied clients who may be tempted to come to me or to whoever's listening to sell the house. And we were unable to fulfill that need, that niche for the sales piece. So I don't know that doing more flips is the great answer in the pedestal to go after. If we're talking, 400K, give or take houses on 30 sides, like the money in the end is not that bad, especially for not having to take any risk whatsoever. I'm curious if you, so we're doing probate leads, you have a nice niche carved out. I imagine you're doing some, advertising to them. Are they expecting you to come out, make an offer on this property in like an investor sense typically? Or are these people that picked the phone up and said, Bill, I want you to list my property as an agent?
So I don't have exact numbers, as of now, but of the 32, probably 22 are listings sold. And usually I'm working with a seller or an estate or an attorney, and they're not expecting an offer. They want me to represent the property and sell it to get the highest and best value for the most part.
Okay.
The 10 buyer sides are properties I found in my marketing that, either didn't list with me, listed with somebody else, weren't listed, that I found and brought a buyer in on and said, hey, this is a deal I think you make some money on. And I call that paid lead generation, because of the 10 buyer sides I have, I think probably 6 or 8 of them will be listings next year as those investors fix the property up and flip it and bring it back to market. So I do both sides of that, but I don't often get a seller and then offer them the opportunity both for cash or listing. I do that occasionally, but I think that they're calling me as an agent. So that's normally how that conversation goes once I talk to the seller.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah. I want to circle back. You mentioned that you did the faux partner showing up with your brother early on in the business. And I remember my own first 6-8 deals, something like that. In my mind, I didn't really have money lined up. I didn't have money myself. And in my mind, I convinced myself that I had a partner who was willing to come in on the deals. And then on faith, I went out and negotiated deals and then ultimately did find some partners to come in on certain deals. Ultimately found private money. Ultimately, my partner was somebody that I wholesaled the deal to. But for me, coming from a place of like zero money, zero contacts, not a lot of resources, I had to set the partnership mindset in my head and sort of, you know, fake it till you make it in a sense to go out there and then negotiate in confidence and faith that I'd be able to go find those partners on the end. So great strategy for me, you know, doing the fake partner kind of a thing as a mindset early on and just going out there to be the source of the deals. And I want to touch on briefly here, you know, your brother probably bought properties in a time where the values were cheaper, not that you could run out and buy $450,000 houses and rent them out in cash flow today in these markets. But one thing in my own personal rentals, and I've only owned rentals for 6 years, let's say, I think I've been in the business about 15 years, flipped a lot of houses during that time. I feel like when I was buying every one of those houses that I was like paying too much for the houses. Yeah. Keep in mind, my frame of reference is buying at a price that I can fix it up and then sell it for a profit, recoup all the construction costs. So I kind of have a discounted mindset typically going in. But every property that I bought felt like I was paying almost a premium. And I don't want people listening to think you run out and buy any piece of property and then eventually it appreciates and you're okay. But I think what I'm getting at is there's a certain level of patience for me, where the rentals started to make more sense as the rents inched up. Suddenly, the neighborhoods continued to mature. I select properties in neighborhoods that I think are going to mature price-wise. Right. So again, I'm stressing that I'm not overpaying for these, but as the time marches on, I'm amazed at how important the patience and the time marching on part of the buy and hold strategy is for it to become exciting. So in the first 3 years, Bill, I'm looking at these properties thinking, I got to get these tenants out of here, sell it, break even, get the hell out of these things. These are bad deals. I can't believe I bought them. And then, you know, another year or 2 years goes by and suddenly, you know, they've gone up in value 20, 30, 40%. And they aren't all going to go up that fast, but the rents inched up too. So suddenly it went from, you know, $150, $200 a month to $300 or $400 a month over that same, you know, 5 year period. And I just underline the amount of patience that's needed for that buy and hold strategy. Yes, you have to buy right. Yes, you have to manage right. But man, the time has to come in before we get to a point like your brother where it really starts to make sense, right?
Yeah. I think it's all business. I think the long tail, if you can play for the long tail, you're going to come out ahead. But we also have to pay the bills in the short run. So you have to figure out how do you balance that or how do you manage that process. And so for me, I mean, I'd love to do more flips. I'm very concerned about Los Angeles as a market where I live. I every day gets worse. Every single day, it just the depths of the problems of owning property with tenants scares me more and more. But with a lipstick flip, I don't really care. And as a broker, I don't care. They have to sell at some point. So I'll help them do that. I think that's part of why I haven't done more. But I would say that, you know, I look at deals all the time with the idea of trying to find something that's worth investing in. But I don't believe I would do, I don't think there's any property I would buy today that I'd rent out. I just don't think I would do it today in Los Angeles County. Other states, yes. Maybe other counties, yes. But there's nothing here, because it is the long-term game. And you know, you have to feel good about where you are long run. My brother did well because he picked an area that was up and coming. He was doing financing for a lot for builders in new neighborhoods that were, and he could see the good ones and who was buying properties and things like that. So I think you're right on that. You have to pick an area that's rising or growing in the long run in order to survive that long tail. And then the short run, you know, quick flips are a way to make some money and income in the short time, but they're not a long-term hold.
So how else does the long tail mindset or philosophy play into your business, Bill?
You know, I think as an investor, every investor who I've seen is successful over time. Now, everybody's a genius this past year, right? Every idiot who borrowed money, overpaid, improved and resold a property in a decent market made money this year. And they're all geniuses writing books and setting up coaching companies to teach you how to do what they did. I've been around long enough to see those people come and go over time. The ones who stay, the thing I notice consistently is they're playing a longer term game. As an investor, what that means is when you go meet a seller today who might be distressed but doesn't choose to sell today, he might not sell for 2 years. The average lead is about 2 years. And so the investors that I know find some way to stay engaged with that person over a longer period of time and will tell me that they get deals that come back to them a year, 2 years later, 3 years later, 5 years later. And that's the real profit is that person who knows you, likes you, and trusts you and comes back to you later rather than under the competitive environment of marketing. And there's nothing wrong with marketing. I do it all the time. But when you're generating leads off of strangers, by definition, it's more competitive. They want to compare you to everybody else. Who's going to promise me more? You know, well, this guy says he'll give me an extra $20,000. And I always tell them, well, if you call long enough, somebody will offer more than that guy will too. But so the answer is I feel that it's a relationship business. And if you play for the long term, then you also get that business. And that's the more profitable business.
Yeah. And I mean, I love direct mail for marketing over digital sources. They all produce leads and we do all of that, right? But the direct mail in my mind has always been this like savings account in the marketplace. And what I mean is like every letter that I deposit is like potential seed that sprouts in the future. And there's people who've, you know, probably gotten letters for years on end who finally picked a phone up because they're not ready to sell day one when I just happened to think it was the right time to send a letter. Right. So over time, that momentum builds in a marketplace. And I think, you know, a lot of newer investors who might try some marketing, you spend $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 on letters and maybe not get much, right? But that kind of an investment over the course of, you know, a 2 year, 3 year, 5 year period, you're going to reactivate people and they're going to get to know your name over time. So that's why I always was a fan of that physical piece of mail. I mean, that can get tucked in with mortgage documents, with the estate plan. That letter written correctly. I mean, this has the potential to really, like you said, kind of have the long tail as far as the marketing goes. Newspaper, it's trashed. A TV ad, it's gone in an instant. A Facebook ad, scrolled past. But man, you get that direct mail placed in the hands of a seller, it has that potential to really hang around for forever.
Especially if, you know, it's funny, I get involved with different organizations that sell coaching and data. And every single week I get warranty people say, well, you know, I mailed out and it didn't work. What'd you do? Well, I got the list and I mailed out a piece to everybody. Well, yeah, that doesn't work. You know, I tell people you have to have a plan to address that lead for 2 years minimum. Your return on investment can be 200% over 2 years. It might break even year one. And then all of a sudden you get one or two or three more deals and that makes the whole thing profitable. So you definitely have to have some way of staying in touch with people. Maybe it's just repetitive postcards or various postcards over time, but you can't just mail them once, expect a return that's going to build a business over time. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, 100%. So we touched on the LA market, the California market. Everyone in the country knows it's hot. Can you describe the conditions of that target market that you work, those, you know, six, seven or eight counties where you've done business in Southern California, you know, average price, average days on market, maybe who are the buyers on, let's say the 30 transactions or so that you were involved in?
Well, those are two different things. My business tends to skew to fix and flip properties and investors and lower to middle, lower income, just the nature of probate skewers lower income, lower price points. So my average transaction is about $500,000. And, you know, it's a fix and flipper buying it and he's going to fix it up and bring it to market for $650 or something. LA overall, I'd say Southern California is a strong market, not as strong as some other ones, but stronger than average across the United States. Which is surprising because our economy is doing poorly, but people love to live here because the weather's good. And I think people believe in the long run that that's going to be important. What else?
Days on market. How quick are they going?
You know, so can I just share my personal philosophy on this? I think this is one of the big lies of our industry. So I started in the business, and you'll hear people say all the time that anything below 3 months is a seller's market, right? And that was true in 1980. The analogy I like to use is our local Ralph's, our local grocery market. When we moved here 20 years ago, half the market was customer facing and half the market was back room storage and supplies and boxes of stuff that haven't been unboxed yet. And every day they'd add stuff to the front of the office and once a week they get deliveries in the back. Nowadays at Ralph's, 90% is consumer facing. They get deliveries all day long every single day. They turn over the inventory, you know, every 24 hours. I remember when I was in business school, we used to talk about turning over retail clothing in months. My daughter works for Ross Department Stores, where they measure it in terms of days or weeks, because the internet's allowed companies to watch their inventory more carefully and turn things over. The same's true in real estate. It used to be you had a MLS book once a month, every other week, and then every other week you got the update book. And so as a realtor, you got the full book every other week and you got the update book once a week. And then you go through it and read it and call your customers and show them properties. Well, nowadays, customers get pinged on properties before I do. And so any house that's on the market more than 2 weeks, 3 weeks, by definition, is overpriced, right? And so when people talk about days on market, I don't think that just talks about how many people are willing to sell their house and don't realize the market's shifted maybe, or how many are encouraged to come in and overprice their house, hoping to get more than it's worth. But it doesn't mean the market's, I don't think 48 days is different than 17 days in terms of the market. It has more to do, I think, with the realtors. There's too many realtors per house, and there's realtors willing to list anything to generate business. So to answer your question, I would say days on market are, you know, under 30, probably about 25 days. You know, in some price points, it's higher because there's more realtors and they're desperate for listings, so they'll put it on the market. And you have sellers there that say, yeah, sure, my house is worth $1 million. If you want to list it for 1.2, yeah, what the heck? How could it hurt to list the property? Just don't put a sign up. I'm not going to do an open house, that kind of thing. So I think that's just more about the marketing than the actual market. But overall, I would say that homes are selling, you know, pretty quickly. You know, I look at the statistics, I would say that the average offers per house is about 2. Right now, which is historically high. There are stories of people who will get 20 or 30 or 40 offers or more on one listing, but that's just the listing agent who was able to create an auction environment by listing the price low. I've done that. If you know you have, let's say, a property's worth 500 and I have an investor who'll pay 500 for it, I might go to the seller and say, well, let's just list it 300. My guy will offer you 500, but everybody will see the house and offer on it and we'll get 50 offers. And you have buyers who'll call and cry, I want the house so bad. I offered 350. It's over list price. You know, that property is an auction. It's not really a listing. And so, again, you have to look at your terms and your data. But to answer your question, in general, our market, homes are selling within 2-3 weeks of the price right. And if they're not, and the prices are still going up, just more slowly than they were a few months ago.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the price point and behaviors that you describe in the California market. So we're talking 400,000 or 500,000. And these are like, this happens, what you just said. You had 300K listings and people are crying. That happens in your market? That's like a strategy, I guess, for some agents, right?
Yeah. It's a strategy. And the buyer's agents don't properly explain to the buyer, look, this house is much lower than everything else for a reason. They're going to just auction off and they're looking for 50 offers. And so you're not just offering the list price isn't enough. Just wanting it isn't enough. It's a competitive environment that you have to compete in.
Yeah, it's interesting because with a 500K, you know, almost a median price point that you described, a 300K listing is this like very magnetic anomaly. And if I think I'm in Chicago, I'm in Atlanta, I'm in Philly. So I look at comps and we do a ton of business in all three of those markets. And we're also with a foot in Phoenix, not doing very well. Phoenix is behaving more like you're describing, and we haven't gotten our legs there because the models are just different. So for example, you know, we're probably in median home prices, if I had to guess, around 250,000 in the Atlanta market. And we're probably closer to 300,000 in Chicago and in Philadelphia across the board. So it's significantly lower. And if we were to do this price it low strategy, the low pricing is not going to be, you know, 60% of what the market's going to be. Like, we're going to come in, I don't know, 10, 20% under the cash. So like, if everything is selling for cash for 90 or 100,000, it's going to need 100K rehab. We probably could list that at like 70, and we're going to have that kind of auction environment. But like, throwing it any lower than that's going to be almost, there's no need. You're still going to get, you know, 10, 20, 30 offers, even if your price is that low. So it's interesting to hear that strategy have such larger numbers. And we have days on market in Atlanta, we'll say like a renovated property, right? So it's apples to apples to apples in Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. A renovated property in Atlanta is probably sold within 4 or 5 days. It's kind of odd if it's on longer than 5 days. Wow. A lot of them are sold in 1 or 2 days. And to me, it's an agent really didn't do their work right. They probably had a pocket buyer. They didn't really let it run to the market as they should have and handled their, you know, their sale correctly if it was sold in a day or two. But 5 days, the agents know what they're doing in Atlanta. They got what I would consider to be a market price in real time. Now, that market still is flying up. You know, I don't know about as we speak, but certainly over the last 6 months and year and a half, it's definitely flown up, even the last 3 or 4 years, Atlanta. But if we take a Chicago and a Philadelphia, these are much more constrained marketplaces. You know, the fluctuation in inventory and the migration patterns are not going to increase the values dramatically. We still saw run up in pricing, but a renovated house outside of the city of Philadelphia is probably about a 10-day market cycle, maybe a little less, maybe 14 days. And if we're in the city, there's so much renovated product that comes on that we're probably 14 to 30 days on market in the city. And then when you get to Chicago, it's kind of the same thing. Suburbs are going to be, you know, 2 weeks or less on a renovated property. And then in the actual city of Chicago, we're going to be 30 days, give or take. It's funny to see this maybe FHA-driven city buyer has a lot more options because there's so many more houses to choose from in the inner city. But it's interesting just to kind of hear the snapshots of California and then putting it into the context that I'm so used to here and now. And Phoenix has been exactly what you're talking about in California. And that's going to be the putting a 650K price on the listing that probably should have been offered at 450. And, you know, that seems to be, it doesn't make any sense to me at all, Bill. One of the things that seems to have happened is COVID sped up the migration rates. And what I mean by that is you have people in California who probably have high incomes and are now able to work remotely. And they're like, you know what? I'm done with the taxes. I'm going to Phoenix. I'm going to Austin. I'm going to Atlanta. Same thing with people from New York City, from Philadelphia. I had half a dozen friends move in the last 18 months from Philadelphia down to Florida. And I could probably pick the same half dozen from Chicago to Florida, probably tax reasons. But when you look at that redistribution of, let's say, probably higher incomes that occurred, maybe it justifies the quick jump in prices as higher incomes migrated into these areas, right, to sustain a lot of these like secondary, slightly lower price markets than, let's say, New York City or Los Angeles, right?
Well, when I, you know, move from LA and sell a house for, you know, $1.8 million, and buy a similar size, newer, nicer house in Boca Raton, Florida for $500,000. So if I pay $525,000 and I get it, what do I care? It's a different business. It's a different life. I think that's part of it, is the numbers that change these things. And the local agents can get frustrated with their local homeowners, but I think that's part of the difference. I also think when somebody says that, you know, when it's sold in 3 days or 5 days, you know, you have to compare apples to apples and how business is done. You know, I could take a listing, and there are a lot of the agents who will take a listing and then not market it for 10 days. And they'll do their photos and look at their marketing stuff all ready to go. And they'll pre-announce to their database they're going to have an open house, or they have a pre-open house for their friends and family and whatever. And they market it day one. And that's I think, more serving the agent than the customer. I always tell people, once you decide to sell your house, the more people know about it, the higher price you're going to get, period. And all this off-market pre-preparation stuff, again, it helps the agent. I get that. But it doesn't really help the customer for a dollar for where I sit. And so usually the shortest I can see a house really selling, if I was to take a listing, I list your house today, I can shoot photos on my iPhone. I have iPhone 13, great camera. But you know, if I'm really going to market a retail house and want top dollar, I'll send a photographer in and set up a video thing and a 360 and all that. And that costs about $300. So you'll need me to schedule that a day or two out, and I'll get them back a day or two later. And then we'll schedule. You might say, well, we're not ready to show it yet. We want to tidy everything up. Give us, till the weekend or the next weekend before you want to really start showing. So there's about a 7-day to 10-day period before the first showing that normally a customer wants you to kind of wait from the day they sign the contract. When they choose me, we agree on a price, we agree on the strategy. There's about 7 to 10 days for the customer kind of get ready and for me to get the stuff ready. And if I do that off market, it makes my stats look better. My days on market are shorter, but it doesn't help the customer. And so I've had numerous listings where I listed it day one. We said no showings until a certain date, but we had like a highly motivated buyer, highly qualified, all cash, come in and say, look, you're listed at 700. Here's an offer for 740, all cash. All we need to do is walk through the property. We'll waive all contingencies. And I call my client and he's like, sure, let him do it. And literally we have the offer in our hand before we even have it available to the public, scheduled. So I think that sometimes these numbers can be a little misleading, but and each market has its own way of doing business. But I think as a buyer of property, individual, when you look at a property, when you see it on the market for one day, you know they had that buyer lined up ahead of time. That's just all that means. And you have to figure out your strategy to be that person if that's the property you're looking to buy.
Yeah, fair enough. So you've really had a focus on probate. Can you describe the evolution of your business toward that end?
I left management 3 years ago and I had to go back into production, and I sat down with a great coach, Don Hobbs, who's my sponsor at eXp as well as a president of Success Magazine. And he has a great video on YouTube on the brand is you for real estate brokers and agents and the importance of a niche and a brand. And I said, I have an idea that I want to do probate. I knew the business. I'd done some, but I wasn't an expert by any means. And we sat down and really implemented kind of his vision of that. And so I did all my lead generation in probate, all my marketing in probate. I think sometimes agents and investors fear that if they brand themselves as one thing, they miss out on the rest. And you'll hear real estate agents say, I specialize in first-time home buyers, investors, senior housing, REO, short. I specialize in everything. Well, you can't. But it's interesting that because I specialize in probate, consumers assume I can sell their house because it's kind of like being a brain surgeon. They assume I can handle a common cold because I'm a brain surgeon. And as a realtor, they assume I can sell their house because I'm a probate expert and I do the volume of business that I do. So it's been great for me. I started lead generation in probate by going to court every day in LA County. And I met wholesalers, investors, homeowners, attorneys, and marketed with them. At COVID, a year ago, March 2020, that stopped. They closed the court and I had to move to online. So I do online and I do 2 video calls a week. I do one on real estate investing for wholesalers, investors called realestateinvestingzoom.com. That's Tuesdays, 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern. And I do probate weekly, Thursdays, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And those are my primary ways to meet people are those two Zoom calls where I meet people and we talk about real estate investing or probate real estate. And so that's been my focus on my marketing. And most of my business is probate, but I get attorneys refer me business. I get estates that aren't probate as well as a result of all that.
So what is probate and why are probate leads so promising for both real estate agents and investors, Bill?
So my good friend, Tanya English, taught me that probate is when you die, you suing yourself and then whatever crumbs left over go to your heirs at the end. And you would avoid that. So in most states, I'm in California, the most litigious state, the most detailed probate laws, but they're also cumbersome in most states. I've done this in New York, Florida, Illinois, Michigan. I haven't done as much in Pennsylvania. But what happens is when somebody passes and there's nobody else on the deed, how does the property go to their heirs? If mom and dad both pass, how does the property get passed down to the son or daughter? And generally speaking, you have to, even if you have a will, that's the big misnomer. In most states, a will won't transfer the title. The will has to be probated or executed in court in order to be effective. So you want to avoid that. If you own property, you want to sell it, you don't want to have to go to court to get that approval. And then if there's multiple heirs, multiple siblings, maybe a dysfunctional family, they're fighting, then you have to hire attorneys, it gets litigated and gets expensive. So in California, to probate a $1 million house, you can have $7,000 of a mortgage against it, but the fees will cost you $10,000, $20,000 or more just to go through the process. Whereas if you had a living trust, you avoid probate in most cases. The living trust is like a neutral entity. You put your title in there and it has instructions when so-and-so passes, give the property to so-and-so. And that gets handled outside of the court or outside the probate business. So that's kind of an overview of the process. It's complicated, so it's hard to do in realtors is almost by definition, most of the time the property is sold. Now, sometimes heirs get a property and they grew up there and they want to keep it as a rental. And sometimes there's a tenant in there and they want to keep it, or a family member, they want to keep it. But the vast majority, somebody was living in it and died, and it's not suitable to keep. Oftentimes the condition of the property, you know, older people tend not to take as good care of it. It's worn or run down and needs to be rehabbed. And that's why flippers get involved. Or just in general, they want to sell the property because they don't have a use for it.
Yeah, it's, we don't really, I mean, I guess we do actually do probate marketing, but it doesn't seem like many deals come from there as much as they probably did 5 or 8 years ago when we first started. Probably an indication of the competition. People know about probate deals and kind of their good fit with real estate investors. A lot of times, Bill, what we find is we didn't like do probate marketing, but people approach us and they've inherited a house and someone passed away. And it's like right. This tangle of issues to get the probate done. So we end up actually doing probate on these deals that came from some other variety of channels, right?
Correct.
Probate deals in general, right? The same way you said, like the estate house, we really love being part of taking that house to the next chapter. I know when I got in probate, it's like, oh my gosh, this person just lost their mom. They lost their dad. I'm this 26-year-old kid. Both of my parents are alive. It was like heavy emotional business. I mean, you have a lifetime of memories that took place in this house. And now you, the investor, you, the real estate agent, you have the nerve to now send me a letter. There can be some like, I don't know. There was trepidation for me and even wanting to like deal with that. And we recognize the emotional gravity now of helping to close the chapter for the family. And then not only that, but there's a new chapter for that house. And I want people, when they sell the property through our company, Diamond Equity Investments, I want them to feel good about it. And we like email out photos of the property after the renovation. They kind of get to see the transformation. And it's bittersweet for our sellers to see that, you know? It's like almost, for me, my childhood home was renovated, went, you know, it was sold, then renovated, went through foreclosure to the guy that we sold it to. He passed away, went through probate, then it was bought. I guess it didn't go through probate. The bank took it back. Someone bought it. They renovated it. And the house looks nice, but it's not the house that I grew up in. So there's this like bittersweet feeling of, you know, the house full of memories that's then renovated. But I think overall, most people realize that, you know, we're not going to hang on to this house. We're not going to renovate it and move back into the house as the heirs a lot of times. We know it's going to have to go on to the next, you know, portion of its journey through time. And for us, it's been very rewarding to be a part of that process. Now, a lot of these processes in probate, the deals end up dying. The litigation can never get through. It's stuck in litigation and the heirs can't get on the same page. Basically, the problem I'm going at, Bill, is probate deals take forever. Have you found any other tricks besides the living trust to avoid the probate is there any other tricks that speed up the probate process that you've discovered in your focus and career?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would say that that's number one. And I promote that to my clients and to other agents and investors to promote to themselves and to their loved ones and clients. The second I would say is that it might be stuck. I can't speak in Pennsylvania, but in California, in LA County specifically, it might be stuck for you, but I know how to unstick it. And I think that's the difference between a professional and somebody who comes across them once in a while. And I don't mean to be disrespectful. I'll give you a statistic. When I pull the data, you know, we have the filings of probate cases in Los Angeles County. There's about 800 a month. When I sort them by attorney, 95% of cases are done by attorneys who've done one probate or less in the last 12 months. So my way of looking at it, 95% of probate cases are handled by attorneys who know less than I do about probate for sure. And I noticed this because I would go into court and I would see what looks like a smart guy. He probably is smart. He went to a good law school. He went to law school. He got his law degree. He's a smart guy. He passed the bar. But there's a big world of law. It's kind of like in real estate. Legally, I have a license that lets me sell houses, retail buildings, and the Golden Gate Bridge. I don't know anything about the Golden Gate Bridge. I would never sell it. I would bring in a partner and refer it or something. But attorneys will take that case because it sounds like it's easy. How hard can probate be? I learned that in law school. Answer, it's very technical. It's not hard. There's a lot of little details. It's kind of like in the mortgage industry, VA loans. It's not the VA loans are all that hard. They just have their own little detailed pieces of paper that if your processor is not a VA loan processor and that's all she or he does, you're screwed big time in most companies. So I was saying probate, the key is to find an expert who knows that county's procedures and knows that state's laws and then make sure it's not, see if it's stuck or not. Because I just see all the time, that's what I specialize in. This case has been in court for 2 years and the seller hates the attorney now and the heirs are all fighting. They're fighting because the house didn't get sold and the money didn't get split up. And the attorney made a fundamental mistake 2 years ago. And it just goes on and on and on and on. I find, unfortunately, attorneys are very smart people, but very poor at taking advice from anybody else as a general rule. And I think attorneys, as a general rule, sound great when they know nothing. Like, think of politicians. They're all attorneys. So all politicians sound like they know everything when they know nothing. And that's the key about probate is I would say to you, make sure it is stuck. It might not be. Find somebody who's an expert in that county, in that probate space, and just make sure it's stuck. Because I've come across plenty of deals where I would just say, if you just step aside, I can solve this problem for you. That's what I do.
So is that an opportunity for you? You're almost on the hunt for like a probate that was what filed and is still open and active in the courthouse for a long period of time. This you
love
find?
Love it.
Okay.
And also, you know, it's like everything else in real estate. When it's brand new, they feel like it's a beauty pageant. They're going to interview 20 realtors and pick the one that makes them feel the most proud to have their listing. After a year and a half of struggling and watching the attorney and the agent not perform properly, and I walk in and say, well, here's the mistake he made. Here's the mistake he made. Here's a mistake on the marketing. Here's a mistake on the documents on the probate side. They're like, wow, where have you been for a year and a half? Well, a year and a half ago, you thought all that mattered was the commission. Now you realize you can't sell the house without me. And that's where being an expert, I think, is the difference.
So you step in on a stuck probate. How fast is it that you resolve? I mean, you mentioned this quick audit of the mistakes. Are you solving the problem in a month, 2 months, 3 months? Could it sometimes still end up being another 6 months or 12 months because the problem is that sticky? I mean,
you know, they're all different. I mean, I've seen cases where the guy went to court and was continued for 4 or 5 months through COVID, denied at court. And I said to him, look, I'd like to represent you and get the commission, but let me tell you what you have to do. And he just refiled the paper and sold the property within 2 weeks. He
wow.
didn't need court confirmation. Other ones that take longer because it's now you have hardened feelings on both sides. It's just hard to get everybody lined up. But because that's all I do, it's worth it. Even if it takes 2 years to unwind, There's attorneys that I get to meet. There's other vendors I get to work with. So for me as a business person, I'm fine if it takes 2 years. It's not about, I don't just get paid on that transaction. I think that's the other thing I would say. You know, the way my first coach was Zig Ziglar. He said, you can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people get what they want. So if I help you in this transaction and it does take 2 years and I don't get paid for 2 years or I never get paid, somehow I get paid on the next deal. It just works out that way. So I hear what you're asking. It's a fair question. I would say to you, don't get caught up in how soon I get paid. If I help solve that person's problem, then I'll get paid somewhere down the road. And if it takes them 2 years, if they create such a big mess that it takes 2 years to fix, but nothing really should take, there's no reason why anything should take 2 years unless the litigants just want to battle it out. Now, the truth is, litigation can be like a war. And if people want to go to war for 2 years, there's not much you can do about it. But absent that, usually there's a reason why people don't want to litigate. And if you can help solve the problem, then that will, for example, I had a case where man dies, nephew is the administrator, but this woman claims to be his wife. There's no record of any ceremony. There's no record of any documents, not legal, but she wants to litigate it. And anybody can sue anybody for anything. But we got them to agree at least to sell the property and put the money into escrow or into an account. So they're not accumulating a mortgage and property taxes and all that. The money is sitting in an account waiting for them to settle their litigation. So at least it solved that part of the problem.
Yeah, it's funny. It's eerie to hear you describe the hunt for problem probate properties. So we deal with the same thing. We make a deal. We line up our expert probate attorney, which may or may not be the expert. I'm going to dig into that later here on the heels of our conversation to see how much of an expert they are based on volume in the counties that we're doing business. Mm-hmm. Each county is different, but the dance begins, the contract is signed, everyone's on the same page. And typically, Bill, a lot of these deals end up shaking out like we're fronting the $4,000, $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 in probate attorney fees up front to be recouped at settlement. But then no matter what our positioning is on the front end, the value of the service, the loan, diminishes as time goes on. And now they're more and more aggravated because we haven't been able to perform. In their eyes, we screwed them because it's taken so long. And it may only take 3, 4 months, 5 months anyway, based on the court and as fast as we could possibly get it through. But there's always, I mean, I don't want to say always, there's some sellers who, you know, we're doing business with and they stand by their word and they're pleasant to deal with through the entire time. There's a certain percentage of the difficult ones that kind of behave and act like you did. And suddenly things are just devolving and falling apart. And everyone's, you're probably over there calling them saying, you got a solution for me on the other side, or someone in our county that's like kind of feeding it in their ear that it's a big problem, how we handled it. I don't know. But I guess that whole setup for me observing that truth is to ask you this. Is there some way that you're managing expectations on a probate that is a 6 or a 9 month kind of a scenario? Like, how are you holding it together, if you will, during a probate process that you can't get it done in 2 weeks?
Are you asking if I promise in 2 weeks how to hold together for 6 months? Or
no, you can't get the probate clear in 2 weeks. Right? It's going to be a 4 or a 6 month or whatever. So, month 2 or 3, what are you telling your seller to keep them engaged in the process? How are you like managing this relationship over that time?
You know, real estate agents tell me how busy they are, and I submit offers and they can't respond, they can't text back or email back. And I laugh because they have a core of the business that I have. I have today 5 pending escrows. I have 6 listings are active. I got a new listing contract in and closing tomorrow. And yet I contact every seller every single week and tell them what's going on. And sometimes it's just no change. And it's just a quick phone call. And then I'll either text or email them a line or two as to what's going on. And I just manage, that's just a minimum standard, is every week I'm in contact with them to where they go, Bill's on top of it. I don't have to worry about it. Number one. Number two, it takes longer than it should because somebody's not doing their job. I'll give you one free tip that will save you. If you're spending $48,000 on legal fees on a standard probate, you can use a service called easy-probate.com. They're kind of like the LegalZoom, but they focus in probate only. And for my money, they do probate faster, better, quicker, easier, and cheaper than any attorney I've ever met. They charge $650 for a do-it-yourself package, which some clients, some realtors will help the client fill out the paperwork, or $1,250 for what they call concierge level. For my money, that $1,250 is better than the $10,000 attorney. Now, that doesn't cover filing fees. It doesn't cover if there's advertising fees of the property. So in LA County, it can cost an extra $1,000. But even the filing fee, they can file for the waiver of the fee if the person's indigent. But for my money, and they'll take a credit card. And so you're only really out 1 month. And in most probates, you'll make some progress pretty quickly in that month or two. So for my money, that vendor is a critical piece of the puzzle for me. Because now if the attorney's referring me to the business, different story. But if the attorney's not referring the business, being able to get that service and they move faster, better, easier, and cheaper than any attorney I've worked. And they work in all 50 states and almost every county in America.
Nice. That's
easy-probate.com. I actually interviewed the founder on my YouTube channel. My YouTube channel is Bill Gross EXP. Byron Batres is the founder, Byron, BYRONBATRES. And I interviewed him and he goes through his whole program on my on an interview I did with him twice. He's fantastic.
Nice. Good stuff. While we're on the topic of probate leads and probate data, what are the best sources of those, Bill?
You know, it really varies by county. I'm in LA, which is the most competitive, most data sources. So I would say, you know, check various sources. On my website, thelaprobateexpert.com, I have a link to data resources, and I have about 12 vendors I identify there. And I would say in your area, contact them and check your county because every county is different. I'd also urge you to go to Google search the county name probate, and you're looking for the probate court. Most counties have a resource that has rules and has maybe a calendar on it. Maybe they list the cases in some cases. So there's a lot of free resources usually at certainly bigger metro counties for sure. So I don't know where you are exactly. You mentioned several different states. But the bigger counties all have a good resource for agents or investors. Small counties, not as much, but what they do have is valuable. So I encourage people to go to their county probate court website.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff. Is there a book or two you'd recommend? Not necessarily probate, just real estate fix and flip or real estate agents. Is there a book or two you'd recommend to them?
First thing I recommend is alltheleads.com is a website, alltheleads.com. And they have a weekly, either YouTube with a weekly mastermind and a monthly role play. I tell people that they offer more free coaching than anybody gives you that you pay for. They also have a paid program, which I took, is great. Recommend that for a professional. For books, if you go to Amazon, Probate 101 by Kevin Sayles, S-A-Y-L-E-S. If you go to probatedaily.com, again, on my website, I have a link, and probatedaily.com, they, if you buy their data and use a promo code, they'll not only give you a discount. I'm not an affiliate. I don't get any money for it, but they give anybody who uses my code a 20 or 30% discount, and they'll give you a copy of the book for free. So it's actually Foreclosures Daily is the vendor name, and they have a probate department, foreclosuresdaily.com. And if you use promo code BG3005, they'll give you a discount, and then they'll also give you a copy of the book for free. But as far as books, I would say Probate 101 by Kevin Sayles.
All right, cool. So as a wrap-up question here, the crown jewel of wisdom, Bill, if you could go back and tell yourself back when you were having that faux partner lunch with your brother, if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom, everything you know now, go back and tell yourself this, what would that be?
Play for the long game. That means build your database, build relationships. Every person you meet is a future asset in your business. And so play for the long game.
Nice. Any additional contact information, website, anywhere people can go to get more Bill Gross?
Probateweekly.com is my weekly probate call for free. You register there, or thelaprobateexpert.com is my website. And then on YouTube, Bill Gross EXP is my YouTube channel.
All right. Sounds good. Hey, I appreciate you blocking out distractions, giving of your time and wisdom so Thanks. Freely. Thank you for coming on the show, Bill.
Thank you so much, Dan. Appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. And thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Note that the subscribe button may actually now be a small plus sign in the top right corner of the app. Are you interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? Sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the 202 episode archive. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So in 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. And we've done 291 so far this year, with another 5 or 6, maybe 7 or 8 weeks still left to go. Well, mostly houses, a few were apartment buildings, and we currently have another 157 more deals in our inventory, either under construction or awaiting close. I share that, share this. There are 3 ways that you and I can do business. Number 1, if you are interested in having access to real estate deals that you can buy, fix, and flip for profit, go to accessrealestatedeals.com, put in your zip code, and sign up for your local buyers list. Number 2, if you are an accredited investor who is seeking double-digit returns, you can sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com. This is how you join my network of private lenders to potentially fund my projects. Number 3, are you interested in a fulfilling career with Diamond Equity, the nation's premier real estate investment organization? We currently have several openings available throughout the U.S. If joining a winning team with high expectations and high earning potential sounds exciting, go now to diamondequitycareer.com to check out the open positions. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have Drew Walgren joining us to discuss the sale leaseback strategy and why he believes this is the safest passive return available in the commercial real estate market. I'll catch you and Drew next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.